Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, what a great show. Stephen Kurtz is our guest. We're talking about malware, ransomware, security, because Stephen has experience in both the broadcast world and the IT world. It's coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twrt. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, delighted to be here, and I'm in a different Telos Alliance studio this week. I am actually in my Mountain Command Center, otherwise known as the cabin, in East Tennessee, in the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee, and we're taking a little vacation this week, and I had a big project to do to fix some things here at the cabin, but we wanted to bring you This Week in Radio Tech. And amazingly, you know, we can't pick up any TV stations here. We can pick up like one FM station here and a few AM stations, but boy, we got good internet. We got good internet here at the cabin, so that's just awesome. I better be quiet. Don't let the internet hear that too loudly, otherwise it'll retaliate. This is the show, as I said, we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb to the top of the tower, and I'm here today. Chris couldn't join us. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, so if you hear me talking about some of their products or technologies or techniques, that's because that's what I'm familiar with. But it's not about the Telos Alliance, but they do sponsor the studio almost wherever I go, so I appreciate that very much. Chris Tobin could not be with us today. He is off on a personal visit, so he was hoping to, but it's lasting longer than he thought. But that's okay. Our guest today is somebody who is going to easily take up the whole hour with information that I want to hear, and I think you will too. Let me go ahead and introduce our guest. It is Stephen Kurtz from Dallas, Texas. Stephen, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, Kirk, how are you guys? I should just say you. I was expecting Chris too. I'm a little disappointed.
Well, hey, you're talking to, tens, hundreds, or maybe thousands of people on the network and those who download the show. So, yeah, you guys is great.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan, too. So that's this is great. This is great.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I understood that when I first contacted you, you said that you watched the show. So that's exciting.
Absolutely.
Stephen, we're going to get started into some cool stuff, but kind of give us a little preview. You what, a previous radio guy turned IT guy, and you get both sides of the business, yeah?
Absolutely. You know, I worked in several different facets of the radio biz. I was on air, creative services, and then, of course, broadcast engineering, RF, things of that nature. So IT kind of came naturally to me my entire life. And I, you know, had the radio bug from a very young age. So this just kind of evolved into who I am now.
Okay. And IT is becoming such an important, in fact, critical part of broadcast operations. And I think it's just going to grow more and more. And, you know, we've had some guests on the show, a guy like Gary Klein. Gary has done some great presentations on looking at IT as being incorporated into broadcast operations and looking at it from actually kind of the CEO, CTO point of view, where you've got to worry about, hey, what does my mix of talent look like? Now, we're talking about for a big organization, but big or small, IT is critical because more and more and more of our systems depend upon computer networks and computer technology. I think someday it's almost all of our tools are going to be IT related to produce content, whether that content is traditional radio or podcasting, or we take snippets out of our traditional radio content creation and make them podcasts or on demand available, or whether we're doing television type work, or who knows what is coming down the pike in terms of entertainment. But people who produce content are going to have IT systems backing that up and helping them do that. Am I on track there, Stephen?
Absolutely. And you know, you said something very interesting. And I did watch the Gary episode, the one with Gary Klein. And, you know, being a former CTO myself, it's really important to, you know, of course, for me to understand and for all of us, you know, tech people to understand what's going on, but also to be able to communicate that, you know, to the CEO, you know, and to the board at some organizations, and be able to, you know, illustrate its importance. It's just, it's so important. It's and it becomes more important every day.
Well, we're going to take a little bit of a look at this from the 30,000 foot view, but real quickly, we're going to dive into practical things that Stephen's going to help us out. It was interesting, but we did a little show before the show where Stephen and I got to talk, and I gave him a few of my ideas and told him what my weak points were in IT, and I was delighted to find that Stephen and I are very like-minded on how to help operations along, but also protect broadcast operations from all the malware and ransomware and things like that that are out there that are unfortunately part of our lives with the public internet. So Stephen's got some great takeaways. We're going to go through a lot of these for you. So hey, have your pen and pencil ready, or pencil and paper. We're going to put a lot of these notes in the show notes as well. And Steve said he may even on his own company's website, totalit.com, he will see if he can put down a list there of the things that we talk about, some of the resources. So I would pay attention. Absolutely. During this show. Yeah, during this show. Hey, our show This Week in Radio Tech, episode 446, is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store. BGS. You'll find them on the web at bgs.cc. And one of the lines they represent is from Broadcast Tools. And oh my goodness, you know, Don Wingate at Broadcast Tools makes all these cool little devices that really solve problems. Man, I've used his stuff for years, especially switching satellite channels, just all kinds of tools to use, from silent sensors, things that call out, things that alert you. Well, now Don Wingate at Broadcast Tools has this thing called the Pro Mix 4. Now, believe it or not, this is a little mono audio console. You're thinking, mono? Whoa, hey, that went out in the 1960s. Nope. There are plenty of times when you need just a mono console. A mono console will do. So I'm talking about sporting events, parade coverage, doing a live remote when you have more than one person. The Pro Mix 4 can really help you get that done. Now, some of the features of the Pro Mix 4, well, first of all, it is a full-featured audio mixing console, perfect for broadcast studios and broadcast remotes. And podcasting too. When you just have, you know, when you have human voices, you don't need stereo. It features three mic or line inputs, so each one can be mic or line, as well as a dedicated line input that can be switched between balanced and the internal USB codec. So a lot of times we have audio coming from our computer. We want to play that audio on our broadcast. Well, it's easy to do that because it's got this USB input. You can also then take the output of the Pro Mix 4 and record it on your computer through the USB interface. It gives you a program limiter, balanced and unbalanced mix bus and mix minus output, while offering three independent headphone amps, along with IFB and program pan controls, and a whole comprehensive studio monitoring system. Yeah, all in that one little box. Additional features, well, it's got LED audio output level meter. It's got full duplex talkback capability if you get the Pro Mix Hub 6 controller. That's sold separately. It has an on-air Tally warning light relay output. Hey, how many times have you tried to incorporate a small console like a little Behringer or a Mackie console, and you don't have any way to turn the Tally light on? Well, that's built in because Broadcast Tools comes from the first word is broadcast, right? It can be combined with additional Pro Mix 4s or a Pro Mix 1 unit. Also, the Pro Mix, Hub 6, and hook them together with standard Cat 5 cables. Plus, it can drive multiple AHR 1 Plus headphone systems. So lots of possibilities within the ecosystem provided by Broadcast Tools. Now, here's the cool thing. The list price on this console is less than $700. And the street price, well, where do you get the street price? You contact our friends at Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc on the web, bgs.cc, or give them a call. They're really friendly, and I mean that from years of talking to them and ordering things from them. Call them at 352-622-7700. That's 352-622-7700. You know, most of the people who work at BGS are what you might call lifers. I mean, they've been there a long time. I just saw where my good friend Jessica Shute has been there 17 years. She is celebrating 17 years of working for her family at Broadcasters General Store. So lots of good folks there. Give them a call, and I appreciate BGS sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks also to Don Wingate at Broadcast Tools for being part of that as well. All right, it's episode 446. We're talking with Stephen Kurtz about IT. And Stephen, let's do start for just a minute with that 30,000-foot view. Give us kind of you do lots of IT besides broadcast, so you have a wider world view of business operations and keeping people safe with a lot of different techniques. Give me your view of IT and how what you do relates to broadcast operations.
Well, absolutely. So, you know, as you talked about before, the IT and the broadcast, it used to just be, you know, kind of in the business office, and it got into the playout systems. And then, you know, it's really just taken over the entire, you know, broadcast plant and universe. So really, it goes all the way from your playout to keeping your web streams, your digital streams, your video. You know, radio is just not just an audio product anymore. It's become such an interactive and a multimedia product that IT has to support, and the IT and your IT plan has to evolve to support it. So with all kinds of cool things like VoIP coming into the studio, connecting you to your listeners everywhere, you know, and Kirk, you're an expert at studio VoIP, by the way. And it is all encompassing completely.
You're right. And boy, it's just more and more apparent as we go through time that this protocol, this TCP/IP, and then variants like UDP and real-time protocol, RTP, things like that, that the Cat 5 cable can carry almost everything that we need to produce media, and that's what we do. And you know, we call the show This Week in Radio Tech, because that's where I come from, that's where Chris comes from. But we end up branching out all the time into video technologies and remote control technologies. All of it carried over a Cat 5 cable, and almost all of it carried using this amazing protocol, TCP/IP. So having knowledge of that, I know we've been drumming that on the show here for years, and organizations like the Society of Broadcast Engineers or the IEEE and various state broadcast organizations all keep pushing that, hey, IT is critical. We got to learn this stuff. If you don't want to learn IT, well, plan on spending time maybe twiddling your thumbs at the transmitter side only. And then guess what? The transmitter side gets more and more IT.
Our transmitters are IP too.
Yeah. You know, I've mentioned this before on the show, and I'll mention it again. Years and years ago, an engineer at Eastern Kentucky University, and this was a long time, this was 35 years ago. I don't know how he was this prescient, but he said, you know, someday we're not going to have TV cameras anymore. We're going to have computers that make TV pictures. And someday we're not going to have video switchers in here anymore. We're going to have computers that do video switching. And someday we're not going to have these 2-inch quad videotape machines. We're going to have computers that record and playback audio and video. And I don't know how he was possibly that prescient, but that's exactly what's happened, isn't it?
Absolutely has. And it's so funny because it almost took the amount of time. You know, someday is, you know, it's kind of relative, right, to each person, but it did not take that long. If you think about it, it didn't take long at all for it to really just take over.
So and then the technology that has also come along has been networking. Now we talked about, you know, I just talked about computers that do this, computers that do that, and that's actually one of the presentations I've given at NAB, talking about we went from purpose designed equipment to general purpose computing and make it do things, right? But networking these things together has been a wonderful boon, you know, getting your information passed around and letting different parts, different things in the network do different functions. But it also comes at a risk. And so I figured probably the best thing that we could spend our hour really talking about is how to design your networks to minimize risk to those networks, or risk to the broadcast operations, and then risk to the business operations. How we can design things to minimize that, how we can work on our operations, our daily operations, what are some things we can do to minimize risk? And I'm really talking here especially about ransomware. We'll get to that in just a minute. And then how can we train people, since people are usually, you know, the cause of that, of ransomware or other malware getting into systems? How can we best mitigate, you know, the kind of the worst part of the system, and that's people? How can we work on that? So that's, I'd like to kind of focus our hour on minimizing that kind of risk. You may have seen, Stephen, and it was in the news about a good sized media company here in the U.S. Townsquare got hit with some ransomware, and it was devastating to them for a few days. I know some engineers with Townsquare. They worked their tushes off over weekends and weeks to get things back going again, to maintain on-air operations, despite the fact that a lot of resources became unavailable to them due to ransomware. I don't know if we need to try to pick apart, you know, what they could have done differently, but let's instead focus on what any broadcaster, including me, I'm you know, the engineer for 14 radio stations on three different pieces of land, you know, the mainland, Hawaii, and American Samoa. So let's kind of focus on what we can do. So why don't we, Stephen, I think, why don't we talk about start by you talking about the risks of malware and especially ransomware. What is this stuff and what can it do that's devastating to us?
So, you know, I want to point out that this large broadcaster is actually, you know, they're a media company as well. And in fact, my wife's company uses the website branch of this large media company to actually do all their websites, their social media, things like that. They were impacted too. All their business systems were down. It didn't just take down their broadcast operation or, you know, encode some music files or whatnot. It took down their entire organization, from their VoIP phones at their desk, their email. You know, luckily their client websites weren't affected, but they couldn't get to the systems to update the website. So, you know, it was client impacting on all levels of the business. So the risk is real, and the risk is now with everything being IP, the risk is every kind of device. It's not just, oh, you know, we might lose some files. It's not that simple. It is, oh, what would we do if our entire business was down? What would we do if we lost everything today? How would we recover? Do we have a plan for that? How are we trying to prevent that from happening in the first place? In fact, I reached out to a friend of mine that worked for this large company while it was happening, and it was just incredible that, you know, it varied so widely. The security varied so widely from market to market within this company. And some markets, you know, didn't get as affected. In other markets, they couldn't even, they were playing music off of literally a web browser. They were playing music off YouTube.
Wow. Oh my goodness. So, again, let's not say here's what they should have done differently, but let's talk about what Kirk should do, what other broadcasters should do. To me, the scary thing is ransomware. Indeed, my business partner and our radio stations that we own together are members of the International Broadcasters Idea Bank, and this is a small closed group of about 100 broadcasters, and you know, there have been people in that organization, at least one broadcaster, that's also been affected by ransomware. I don't know the outcome. I don't know how they got it fixed, if they paid, if they were able to recover otherwise, if they had, you know, good backups and that kind of thing. But let's if we could talk about that specific risk, because of all the things that scare me, that's the thing that scares me the most. And I'm not even sure how much risk I'm at. I'm not in my head, I'm not exactly sure what all is shared with what across my network. I think we're not sharing much at all, but on the broadcast operations side, yeah, we've got some shared folders from different machines, but the salespeople, I don't think they really have much access into our broadcast operations. But, you know, and then we got a couple computers that are dual nicked. So we've got some computers that can see the business network and can see the network that has to do with all the operations. So if you would kind of take us through ransomware, what's the risk here, and where do we start to mitigate that or reduce the risk?
So I'll start kind of with an example of those dual NICed machines. You know, it used to be dual NICs was, you know, your firewall, so to speak, between your two networks. And, you know, by having the dual NICs, you didn't run as much of a risk. But with ransomware, you know, anything that you can touch from your computer, it can touch anything that you're. So let's say one of the biggest pieces of advice I give people, you know, your normal everyday users do not need any kind of administrative rights, even on their local workstation. There are ways around, you know, there are some specific applications that might require administrative rights. There are ways around that, some of which I will post to totalit.com, and I'm going to put up a This Week in Radio Tech twerk. I'll do a twerk page, so totalit.com/twerk, to put up some of the things I talk about here and some of the pieces of advice. But, you know, the first thing you have to remember is anything that your computer or the user that's on the computer, even if they're not an administrator, anything they touch can be encrypted by these things. And these people are out. Basically, they want money. That's really what they want. So they figure the more files they get, the more important files they get from you, the more money, the more likely you are to actually, you know, give in and pay them. And I will say that that there is a lot of success reported by people I know. You know, Department of Homeland Security and the FBI say, "Oh, don't pay these guys, this and that." You know, the people that I've seen that have paid these guys, these people actually do follow through and give you the decryption keys because they want other people to believe that or to know that they're going to get their stuff back, and it increases their chances of getting paid. So it's in these guys' best interest to actually give the encryption keys. I'm not saying that you should do this. I'm saying that, you know, I've seen that that they do actually decrypt. One of the biggest things is completely, you know, isolating any kind of write access to any of your broadcasts, to anything that you don't want encrypted. Think about it like this. If you don't want it encrypted, it does not need to be writable from your workstation. What I mean by that is I see a lot of broadcast networks where a program director or a music director can load music right from their machine into the automation system and actually access the file share on the automation system fully from their machine so they can put music in there. You know, that's asking for trouble. So what I recommend is making one single folder available on that audio system out to your network if you must, and actually copying or being on that machine and uploading the file either through its import interface or, you know, copying it into your audio drive on that actual machine. That way you're not actually the only thing that gets encrypted if you get infected are the files in that particular folder, not everything else, you know, in your entire music library or in your traffic library.
It sounds like you're talking about an ingest folder. So you set up a folder that your automation exactly. system goes and checks. And so it can read from that folder, and the program director or whoever needs access to that folder can write to that folder, but that folder can't then go right to the main database of the automation system, can't write to where all this music's stored. So that folder acts like an Absolutely. Intermediary. Hey, yeah, store your stuff here, and the automation will check me every few minutes or seconds, and if I got something new, it'll suck it in. And that is your barrier between the two, yeah?
That is correct. I've set that up with a lot of different automation systems. It's, you know, some of them you write a script and you can have the script check, or you can actually, you know, go into the automation system and actually upload the file. It just depends on, you know, what you use. But it's really one of the most effective ways at actually, you know, separating your two networks. Another thing is, and I know, I'm sure, you know, I've heard guests before say this. I know you've said it. Do not, your audio machines, your machines that are actually on the air, don't have any business being on the internet. They just, you know, whatever you must do, you need to keep them off the internet. It's just asking for trouble.
So there's plenty of on-air talent that wants to be able to play things from the internet conveniently. And so the only thing I would say is, if you're going to have a machine play things on the internet, be able to play things, maybe its only connection to the broadcast gear should be an analog or AES cable, because so far I don't know of any malware or ransomware that can go through an analog audio cable. Would that be a reasonable?
Not yet. Don't give him any ideas. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I do some consulting engineering work for a college radio station. And, you know, we have a dedicated machine that sits on the internet that actually sits out there. And it's fed right into the board and all that through the audio router. We also have 3.5 millimeter audio jacks. So they can actually plug in if they want to bring in their own laptop or, you know, tablet or anything else like that. That way they can plug in. So we give them a variety of ways. But in any broadcast plant that I work with, you know, the talent, especially morning talent, you know, if I say, hey, you know, you could really just play that off your laptop. A lot of times they've got the laptop set up in the studio anyways. So why not? They just have to remember to turn it off before their email ding comes on.
Yeah. Seems like a few years ago, I heard under good authority that if there's only one thing you could go around your broadcast facility and do, it would be to go to every Windows workstation and make sure that the people weren't running with administrator rights, that they need to be running 100%. As a user. Yeah. Talk to me about that, because it seems like for decades, if you install Windows and start using it, you were the administrator automatically. Now, maybe with Windows 10, that's different now. You tell me, but talk to me about let's say I've got some workstations out there and the people are in fact, the administrator. I didn't realize it. How can I get them to switch over and just be a user and not have somebody as an administrator?
Absolutely. In Windows 10, actually, it's still, let's say you go to the store, you buy a computer or you order one, you open that thing up, you put it on your desk and you set your password and all that, you're the administrator. So what it really takes is just, you know, go into the control panel, create another user, go into the user section, create another user. It's going to ask you what type of user. Do you want a standard user or an administrator? You know, put them as a standard user. Even better, you know, you want to take it a step further, which I do in a lot of broadcast and non-broadcast clients. Most of them, we actually set up a Windows, you know, domain, and we, you know, set up a Microsoft server serving Active Directory. You can do it on an old PC even. That way, you know, you've got a central point of control of usernames, passwords, things like that. It allows, especially if when you have higher turnover positions, such as sometimes salespeople, things like that, it's really easy just to cut them off, and that way they don't have access. But make sure that your users are not admins.
I would love to have something. I've never learned about how to implement Active Directory. None of my broadcast operations seem like they've been big enough to warrant that central control. But you know what? We keep growing. We've got enough employees now. That might be a really good thing. I would imagine there's plenty of resources on the web for somebody like me who understands Windows fairly well, but never did Active Directory where I would have control. How would I find out about how to get that done for myself?
Absolutely. You know, there's a website, you know, like Spiceworks, things like that. Even Reddit has some great forums on there. But, you know, I'll put a couple links up on our up on my page that I'm putting up there for you guys. And just really, and I'm also a resource as well. Did you say 15 facilities? Is that 15 stations?
Yeah, 14 stations or so, and probably a grand total of probably 30 employees across all those stations. Yeah, we have
absolutely
six different locations. Yeah,
absolutely, and you can use one. You know, and if you've got the right firewalls, you know, you can use one Active Directory server to feed, you know, to control all of those locations. So, you know, there's different ways to do it, and you know, just like anything else. But I really recommend it that way. You know, users aren't sharing passwords if, you know, or somebody gets an admin password to a machine or something like that. That way you're controlling, you know, everything from the bottom up, really. You're starting at the very lowest level of the machine, and then you're working your way back up. It really, you know, will simplify your operation in the long run.
Okay, so for guys like me who are part of smaller broadcast operations, and I know that a lot of our viewers and listeners are in the same boat. They're not the corporate size that starts to implement these kind of things. Learn about Active Directory and implement it, and you can put it on a cheap old machine, and we'll figure out ways, because we can talk. In fact, you're going to talk about some solutions for getting different sites to talk to each other over VPN.
Absolutely,
some convenient ways now. So okay, that's good to know. So don't let anybody be operating as administrator. Make everybody operate as user. If you need to, you know, be an administrator to do something, then, you know, hey, you, the IT guy, the engineer, you log in as the administrator, get done what you got to do, log back out of that, and let the users go on as the user.
Windows is really good about asking too. So if they do something that requires administrative privileges, try to install a program, Windows will come up and say, if you're a standard user, it'll say, please enter your username and password or an administrative username and password to do this. Easy peasy. And that way, you know, a lot less risk. Not totally mitigating it, but a lot less.
So another thing I've ransomware, and we talked about this earlier, is at years ago at my stations, when bandwidth was really precious, and we had this fear of employees spending half their day on Amazon.com or perhaps going to naughty websites that they shouldn't be going to. So I thought, hey, here's this solution called OpenDNS. And I thought they'll let you sign up for free, and you get a lot of, you know, basic functionalities. So I made all my computers. I made my router use the OpenDNS as its DNS service. So talk to me about OpenDNS and how that can help not only maybe keep employees from wasting time, but also can keep you a little bit safer from ransomware.
Absolutely. And it's that's actually great. You were so forward thinking when doing that. So that's I applaud you for that. OpenDNS has actually evolved so much over the years. They have actually turned really into a security, just a DNS filter security service. And really what that does, yes, it provides your content filtering. It'll filter out the naughty websites, things like that. You want to block off Amazon.com or Gmail or whatever to keep your employees on task. It's fine. But really what it does is it actually analyzes traffic patterns throughout the whole entire world in real time and tries to find things that match particular patterns, things, algorithms that ransomware and malware viruses use to block these websites. So this ransomware can't call home and get an encryption key. So this malware can't download the rest of itself off the internet. That's one of the biggest things is you might download or it might, you know, you might go to a website that downloads just a very small piece of malware or of the malware mm-hmm. puzzle, and it goes out, it calls out and says, hey, I need the rest of my payload here. That way your computer antivirus doesn't detect it right away. Well, OpenDNS prevents that. It actually, you know, goes out, they actually look at algorithms, and it's all near real time. And it's one of the only services that I've ever seen that can block some of this stuff even before, you know, a lot of the antivirus companies do. So it does a very, very good job at filtering and actually, you know, preventing a lot of this stuff from even getting in your network in the first place. And another thing I notice is, you know, of course, we were talking about the human element, which is always going to be your biggest enemy. The human element, if you type a wrong website, you know, a lot of people still set up these domains that are close to a Google or close to ABC.com, you know, that are malicious. And as fast as they can shut them down, they'll invent new ones. Well, OpenDNS prevents against that as well. Their content filtering automatically, you know, recognizes, hey, this is a deceptive site. It tells you right away and it blocks it for you. So it's really, you know, it's really an easy and fairly inexpensive solution to prevent a lot of this stuff from getting in and you know, yeah, completing and actually infecting your network.
Something else that I've heard for years is that, a lot of ISPs, and they're probably the big ones are better about it now, but for years, the ISP's own DNS server was, you know, the worst, crummiest machine sitting in the corner with dust all over it, just sitting there, you know, acting as a DNS server. But it was often worthwhile to use a third party DNS, not your ISP's DNS. So a lot of folks have used, you know, Google, 8.8.8.8, or the new yep. one, or there's a couple new ones, you know, 1.1.1.1 and 9.9.9.9.9. Yep. But still, I OpenDNS, these people make it their business, to keep you from to control where your computers go. And a part of that is controlling stuff that you don't even know about. And by the way, those URLs that ransomware uses, a lot of those change every day. So they set up, you know, slews of you know, websites, if you will. They're just, you know, IP addresses or servers with a URL, and that's what OpenDNS tries to keep up with. That they see where stuff is going to and say, wait a minute, that's not good. We're going to block that for our customers. Of course, you can whitelist stuff yourself if you need to, and that's no problem. I've had employees say, I need to go to this site to get this information, and for some reason I'm getting blocked. Well, I don't know what. Okay, fine. Well, we'll whitelist that for you. So good advice.
And you know, in saying absolutely, and in saying that, you know, I've seen equipment that is now integrating OpenDNS into itself. Thing I wanted to talk about actually when you talked about routers that make VPN easy if you have multiple sites, or even if you don't, it's, you know, makes VPN server so you can actually VPN into your network easy, is the Cisco Meraki products. And they actually have OpenDNS built in to a lot of the features in there. So it's actually using that at the that intelligence at the router level as well to really prevent these things from getting out there and happening. It's funny. I have a junk machine that I've got, you know, outside of my firewall, and I call it my junk machine because, you know, this is where I test everything. You know, I'll see a link mm-hmm. that come through in an email, and I'm wondering, okay, did this, you know, it'll catch it, it'll get through a spam filter of some sort, and I want to see if the link is blocked, and I'll run it through OpenDNS, and guess what? Boom! Oh, hit that OpenDNS. Or hit that link, and I've got OpenDNS on there, and it doesn't even get through. And OpenDNS says, "Sorry, you can't do this." And they've already gotten it. You know, it that is how quickly they can react to these links and to this ransom and malware.
That is good advice. Good advice. So don't be an administrator and use OpenDNS because that keeps your computers from going out and getting bad stuff to a large extent. Hey, you are watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 446. I'm Kirk Harnack. Along with you today, our guest is Stephen Kurtz of TotalIT.com. And Stephen's a great guest to have on because he's from the broadcast world, but he's in IT consulting full time, so understands where broadcasters, you know, where they stand and what they need. We're going to be continuing to talk about that, including how we, you know, what are some router solutions? How can we use VPNs to our advantage? Where is it necessary or really important to use a VPN? So all that's coming up as we roll along here on This Week in Radio Tech. Right now, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our friends at Calrec.
Calrec Type R is a modular, expandable IP-based radio system featuring three slimline panels, a fader panel, a large soft panel, and a small soft panel easily configured to give the operator full control. Layouts are saved and recalled quickly between shows. A single 2RU core with integrated I/O gets customers up and running fast, and that single core can power up to three independent mixing environments with no sharing of DSP resources. Available in four DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, enabling it to grow with you. Power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches, keeping cabling to a minimum. Type R is fully AES-67 compatible, as defined by SMPTE 2110, which means that it is also compliant with NMOS discovery and connection management specs. All these features combined make Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Calrec for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Go to calrec.com/twert. Well, studio guests, you know, we're only human, and humans cough and clear their throats. We sniff a little bit on the air. Yeah, on the air. You can cure this, though, with the Angry Audio Guest Gizmo. You press the cough button, and it mutes the mic. Every guest needs one of these. You know what else guests need? And that's headphones, which is why each guest gizmo also has a studio-quality headphone amp with individual volume control. What else? Well, you've seen those mic arms with the built-in LED tallies? They're gorgeous, but how do you light them up? The Guest Gizmo does that too, illuminating the red light whenever the mic is hot. Installing the Guest Gizmo in your studio furniture could not be easier. You just need a 2 3/4 inch hole saw and a steady hand. You don't need a router. Your studio gets a clean custom appearance and you get all the credit. So check out the Guest Gizmo and all the other cool gadgets at angryaudio.com. That's angryaudio.com. You need to go there. and see what all they have for you. Lots of cool things to make your studio builds prettier and make your station operate better. And it doesn't have to be a radio station. It could be a podcast studio, too. AngryAudio.com. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack along with Stephen Kurtz, our guest, and we are talking about IT and protecting your station against some of the bad stuff that's out there. You know, what I keep hearing, Stephen, is that security is hard. It really kind of is hard. You got to think about it because the natural thing is for us to just connect things together. You know, something we didn't talk about in the pre-show, Stephen, that it deserves a quick mention, and that is now it's just left my mind. What's that website that's kind of like Google for the Internet of Things? Something IO. What am I thinking of? You can go to that website and like search.
If this and that.
Pardon? Not that one. It shows you all the stuff that's exposed on the internet. And it became famous to broadcasters when Barracks, for example, a lot of Barracks codecs, Shodan.io.
Shodan. Yes.
That's it. We're going to talk about a little bit of do-it-yourself penetration testing, but I've used Shodan to go, hey, what does my station's public IP address, what's it revealing to you, if anything? Is Shodan.io an interesting way to at least take a quick look at that?
Absolutely, it is. And I'll post a couple links on my site as well. There's quite a few. And I would say at least, I make it a part of my, quarterly kind of things to do list just to make sure, run a check on your IP. Run a check on your firewall. Make sure, you're not you're something that you overlooked or something that you thought you opened up for that nice new NVR you got to monitor all your cameras. Make sure something isn't open that needs to be open. There are so many different solutions now that don't have to use your firewall or for you to open up ports in your firewall. It's quite amazing what we're able to do without doing any of that.
Well, let's talk about that, opening ports in your firewall. For years, it was not uncommon practice to open up do a port forward so that you could, or do several port forwards, or lots of them, so you could remotely get in the gear that is at your studio. And yeah, for some time, I know that these so-called script kiddies, a lot of them will get a hacking kit, right? And they'll set up their scripting to go through lots of IP addresses, public IP addresses, and scan.
We used to get Heath kits, and now they get those hack kits. So
yeah, exactly. and I thought, you can do a little bit of security by obscurity, although it's not at all fail-safe. You're still open. But I would use really high port numbers and then port translate those to the port numbers that I wanted within my operation. And I felt safe enough for a while, but I kind of don't feel safe anymore doing that. That's where VPN comes in. So why don't you address this topic of port forwarding? And you know what? Before we get to VPN, let's indeed talk about broadcasters need to remotely get into things. And sometimes we need to get into things where VPN is not a strong possibility. So let's say audio codecs. I want to go do a live remote broadcast and I want to get in and I want to take my Comrex or my Telos thing or whatever it is. And I need to get into the same thing back at the studio. And a port forward has been the way to do that. Is that still the way to do that? Or are there other things that might be a bit safer?
Absolutely. So I am almost positive that Comrex and Kirk, you'll have to educate me on the Telos solutions. They are actually starting to integrate VPN clients in to their codec, to the remote side of their codecs. VPN is always a preferred way. If not, yes, the high port number, that's absolutely the way to go. Also, if you can get somewhere that has a static IP and only open that, let's say you're at a high school football game you want to broadcast and you know that the school district has an IP address of this to this, whitelist that range and don't let anything else in. The smallest, littlest hole that you can open, the better. The smaller the hole, the better.
That's a good point. And at the moment, I don't know of any Telosphere that has actual VPN technology built in. But what I when I've talked to our developers at Telos, hey, let's say you open a port. Let's say you pick some port number that your Telos ZIP 1 is going to be listening on. And typically, it's communicating with the ZIP server. On that port, and the ZIP server, it's a point of presence server that keeps track of, you know, hey, where's the IP address for this particular device, and if you open a port to a ZIP one, I'm told by the developers that that ZIP one will not respond to anything at all that isn't a request from another ZIP one or an RTP stream. From some other codec, if that's the port that you're hitting. So, well, what about, you know, I'm trying to hack into it. They said it throws all that away. Now, I trust that to a large degree. I'm not saying it's hack proof. There's always really good hackers out there, but at least in the world of audio codecs, let's not use the same port number that the audio codec's HTTP interface is on, right? Or its SSH interface or its Telnet interface. But if you're going to open a port for the audio to come in, at least the Telos ones, and I would imagine the others too. If it isn't what they're expecting, they just go, huh, that's not for me. Just drop it. Now, that doesn't prevent a DDoS kind of attack on that port or somebody Correct. Else, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, there's still danger there.
Or an impersonation, you know, you can impersonate, you know, let's say they impersonate an RTP packet and that way, right. you know, maybe inject some audio that you weren't expecting them to inject. You know, it's pretty advanced, but, you know, these hackers are in these guys that are writing this stuff are very, very, very advanced. And we were talking in our pre-show about how these guys are mainly in foreign countries. They have these huge offices in there with benefits and dental and health and all these other things. These are real legit. They're running them as real legitimate operations, and it's insane to me that they're using it for this purpose. But the money, you know, they're going where the money is, and if there wasn't money there, that's, you know, they wouldn't be doing it. So my biggest thing is, yes, it will discard the packets that it doesn't like. However, that does not mean that you're immune to things like a DDoS or even some kind of impersonation attack or, you know, using that to spoof out packets to another IP address. Who knows? They can find something, you know, if you give them a little bit, they'll take a lot.
Good point. Good point. One technique that I've seen some stations use is they get their internet and their corporate WAN, you know, from the corporation. If they need to hook up codecs to the outside world, they'll just get a separate drop from Comcast or whoever their local provider is, and they'll put a router or firewall on that, and that only goes to ports on codecs or other gear that is expecting, you know, where they have to do that. I guess there's good and bad to that. I don't know. Obviously, you want to, if you can get to anything in your business besides that codec on its audio, on a port that's expecting audio, you got to re-examine what you're doing because you don't want somebody to get in otherwise. I've also seen a lot of backlash the other way to where some radio stations or broadcasters have been hit by malware, and in response, they just close everything. And so you can't do broadcasts. You literally can't do a broadcast. So there's got to be, you know,
I never think IT that's the answer. You know, that is never the answer. You know, I've never been a fan of the, well, you know, you guys broke it, so we're just going to pack up our toys and go home. You know, that's, there are good ways to do it. And separating your connections is actually really smart. As we go forward, you know, there are devices actually out right now, such as like a cradle point router, which actually it's kind of funny. I've been seeing these ads on Facebook that are advertising quote unquote trade show internet. And it's designed for people that have that go to trade shows all the time. And it's really just what's called a cradle point router. And what these routers do, they're your normal router. They've got, you know, enterprise features. They've got VPN, so you can connect back to your studio. They'll establish a VPN or to your, you know, back to your office or studio or whatnot. They'll establish a tunnel. They can use anything. So, for example, you can plug in a USB device from an AT&T or a Verizon and they'll establish connection, or you can plug into an internet connection somewhere else and they'll pick up the connection and then establish VPN, things like that. But there are, you know, solutions now to securely do this, and they're not, you know, those routers are not not that entirely expensive. But I have seen, you know, these different companies, at least in beta firmware and things like that, starting to actually integrate VPN, much like some of the commercial or the commercial grade IP phones. A lot of these IP phones that you see have VPN clients built into them, so they can get into the networks of large corporations and make, you know, place phone calls without creating a risk. So I think we're going to see a lot of more of this VPN as a as kind of just a an expected feature as we go along. It's really becoming the norm. I worked with an organization who used to up until actually they still do now in some places, but they actually issue you a public IP address for every device. And you know, that worked great in 2000, 2001, when, you know, or even in the late 90s, when, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. And now they're in a big push to get everything behind the firewall, this, that, and the other. But they're having a tough time because the network is so large. My point there is that, you know, as a broadcaster and having a facility, you know, in this type of setup, it was great because when we first got this IP equipment, we could go and hit it from anywhere and we could do whatever we wanted. Now it's all behind a VPN, and you're, and honestly, you know, your phone has a VPN client built right into it. I mean, your Android, your Apple, your phone has a VPN client built in. You don't have to do anything. You know, you can go in there. I leave mine connected most of the time. In that way, even if I'm on a public Wi-Fi or anything like that, it's not, you know, I'm not being viewed by other folks. So VPN is going to, you know, really, it's already become a way of life.
So let's talk a bit more about VPN. I want to make sure we also talk about the router solutions that you told me about. But so one thing to define is when we say VPN, there are a number of different things that we can mean by that. It's a virtual private network, right? But we hear lots of advertising for a personal VPN, and this is there's free ones and there's paid ones. And they're really for when you are out in a public place, and you want your data encrypted and secure, and until it pops out somewhere else on the internet, and so you don't want to be on if you're on Wi-Fi on a public Wi-Fi. There's even ways to hack into encrypted Wi-Fi, but this helps keep you safe from the people who are around you or from your ISP or somebody else's ISP that you're using. That kind of VPN may keep you more secure at a Starbucks or in a hotel environment or in a trade show environment, but it's not a VPN all the way to your transmitter site. So make sure I've got that right. These VPN services that you can subscribe to, that keeps you safer in your local environment, right?
That is correct. So, you know, there's really three types in my mind. So you've got the commercial VPN, right? These VPN services that you're talking about. And if you ever listen to somebody like Kim Komando, they advertise all over her show. You know, there's all kinds of personal VPN. You know, and originally those were used to actually hide activities. If you wanted to do something maybe that, you know, maybe not been on the up and up, or you wanted to look at something that, yeah, they were used for that. Now, you know, there are these pocket sized devices smaller than your cell phone that somebody could set right now, right down on the table next to you, at Starbucks, and look exactly at your traffic, sniff all your packets, see exactly what you're doing, pick up what you're doing on your bank account, things like that. And so commercial VPNs is what I call them. Those commercial VPNs are perfect for that. The other, you know, two types of VPNs, you've got what I call a client server VPN or a client VPN. That's where you want to connect to your, let's say, Kirk, you want to connect into your business network at your office or, you know, at one of your facilities. You use a VPN client very similar to one of the commercial ones. You use that client to connect to your business, and you can actually go out onto your network and out of your network there, look like you're in the office, work like you're in the office, but you're really, you know, at home or at Starbucks or even on the airplane now. So that's what I call, you know, client VPN. And then the third type of VPN is called a site-to-site tunnel. And what that is it takes your router, this site-to-site, it takes your router and connects it with another router over the internet using public internet, but it's all encrypted, and it basically creates a wide area network for you. So you can hit machines on the other side as if you were sitting right there on that network. A great way to use this a lot, and I see, you know, I use it a lot this way as well. Not only for companies with multiple locations, but any broadcaster, you already have two locations in most situations. You've got your studio and you've got your transmitter site. Connecting your studio to your transmitter site without having to open any public ports on the internet. So you can actually use this environment to basically have two internet connections, one at your studio, one at your transmitter site, and send all the data, audio, whatever you need to send securely and easily. But it's not over. There's no ports that have to be open, so you don't have to share things between open up things from your facility that are going to make you at risk for any other kinds of attacks. It's also very useful if you have, like Kirk, you know, you've got multiple stations, augmenting your networks, connecting them all together. That way, did I have it? I had this spot on the station over here, but I need it over here. So let's go pull it and bring it over. Yeah. You can do it just like you can do it exactly as if you were on the network there at that location from any of your locations. So it really, you know, there's a lot of benefit to the site-to-site VPN tunnels. And each of them are designed to protect you and to protect your equipment just in different ways.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So it turns out that at my radio stations and my transmitter sites that have internet, we're using MikroTik routers, and I have found them, you know, somewhat challenging to set up for more complicated things. They do have a wizard in the MikroTiks to set up a basic VPN server, and then I get into it remotely. But the only one that they set up on the wizard is PPTP. Style of VPN, and so, you know, that's been deprecated by a lot of people. On my Mac, for example, Apple doesn't even offer a client for that. I had to buy a third-party client because it said that it's not secure because the password is apparently sent in plain text.
That is correct.
I got to believe it's better than nothing, but I really need to move to a more secure technology, and I've been studying that on the MikroTiks. I just haven't been able to get it done yet. But and I've loved the MikroTiks. The hardware has been really good for us. We like it in a lot of ways. But I think there's some better, easier to implement technologies nowadays. And let's chat about that for the couple remaining minutes we have. You mentioned Cisco Meraki.
Absolutely.
You're probably going to mention Ubiquiti. For me, the Ubiquiti is probably more in my price line. But tell me about these solutions.
Sure. You know, and yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you had asked me, you know, 5 years ago for a really good, you know, inexpensive firewall router solution that for your situation, I probably would have said MikroTik myself. And MikroTik does make, you know, really good devices, really good hardware. Where they have fallen short is the interface, the user interface, the ability to, you know, get things done and actually keep their OS updated. Not in the sense of security, but more in the sense of features that, you know, are required now for the world we live in today. And so that's why I find a lot of people, you know, shying away from MikroTik, unless you just need to connect to the internet. And for that, it's fine. So yeah, absolutely. So I'll kind of start out, you know, I love the Cisco Meraki gear. I really like their routers / firewalls. They make a great product. Now they're a little bit different than your, they're similar to a SonicWall, and they're similar in price to SonicWall, to a WatchGuard, things like that. They use a subscription model, but they also take it a step further. They are cloud controlled and cloud based. You get your own cloud instance, and it really, they're really plug and play. So let's say you bought one for your studio in American Samoa, and then you put one of your stations in Hawaii. You know, you plug them in, very minimal configuration, all point and click, and you would be connected together in no time at all. They make a great. They also have a lot of advanced security options. They have a lot of the open DNS technology built in. They have a lot of what's called Cisco AMP. That's one of their advanced malware protection. That's built in. Their Cisco ATP, the advanced threat protection. That's another Cisco technologies. And these are things, guys, that you find in the $10,000, $15,000, $50,000 huge firewalls and routers that they've brought down to a cloud based in a easier to swallow price range, like a SonicWall, like a Sophos, or a even WatchGuard, things like that. In fact, I pulled a WatchGuard out of a client the other day, and they were like, "Wow, this is cheaper than the one we had before, and it's so much better." Well, that's right, because they actually realized that they can corner a lot of the market. The firewall market's kind of been a little stale, and they've really brought these advanced features, and nobody's been able to match them yet. A very, very close second, though, I say that kind of with a grain of salt, is the Ubiquiti folks have really done a great job of making all different kinds of products. They make switches, they make routers, they make a lot of cool wireless access points, but also point-to-point wireless. So I've used them in STL situations before, even sure. with some Telos gear before. I've used some of their products over point-to-point links that have less latency than a network cable half the time. So they really have shown that they are a very quite capable company. And one thing, I will go back to Meraki for a second. You know, they do make wireless devices and switches. I don't like those as much, only because they actually brought the subscription model to a switch and to a Wi-Fi device. I don't feel like those devices are as necessary. Your router and your firewall, you want that to be up to date at all times. You want the most security. Your Wi-Fi router, they do it because that's their model, or your Wi-Fi access point, they do it, because that's their sales model. I don't necessarily agree that my switch, I need to have a subscription for it, or it's going to stop working tomorrow when it runs out. So, one thing to keep in mind, I call it my ultimate combination. If I had my druthers, I'll use a Meraki security appliance, and then I'll use a Unify switch and wireless access points and things like that. So going to the Ubiquiti, though, their Unify line of security gateways is phenomenal. They have done really, really well for us. They're very similar to the Meraki in that they work in so many different situations. They're very easy to configure, or they're complicated. They have all the things easy, but if you're a shell guy, you want to get in there and SSH into the device, you can do that too. They also offer to run a Unify device, you need something called a Unify Cloud Controller. You can actually install your own Unify controller locally or on your private network. Or you can buy what's called a cloud key for, I think, they're $100, and you get access to their cloud service. I run my own controller for all of our clients out of a data center. That way we're controlling, end-to-end everything. But it is a complete dashboard of everything, very similar to how Meraki does. It is a complete dashboard of your connectivity. If you want to do VPN, it's all in there. Your client VPN, your site-to-site VPN, easy to set up. They make a really good and efficient device, and their pricing is really unmatched. Your trade-off there is some of the security that Cisco leverages from their other products. Of course, not as much as in the Unify products, but versus a MikroTik or something like that, the Unify, I would take it any day of the week. Absolutely.
Got you. I'm going to be looking into those. And I've used a bunch of Ubiquiti products as STLs, just as you have, even running Axia Livewire across those.
I've done the same thing. And I was that's one of the things with the Axia product and with the Livewire product that just, I was like, wow, I didn't have a doubt that it would work. But when I saw it working over those point-to-point several years ago that I had set up, I was like, I was blown away, because it just, the amount of things we're now able to do, we can put things anywhere and have it work. I was running those off a 120-degree sector from actually using it to do a remote broadcast just very close to a studio, just not in the studio. We did a 120-degree sector out towards, because they had to move around a little bit and had to be a little little bit mobile, but not completely, and it works flawlessly. So they've taken really their expertise and they've built these unified security gateways and really brought it to, you know, the other side of the equation as well.
So we have got to hear from our last sponsor. We'll be back with a tip of the week from Stephen Kurtz. Stephen Kurtz is our guest with TotalIT.com. And Stephen was in the broadcast world doing studio RF engineering, also a talent on the microphone. And now he is into IT consulting. So he gets it from all the ways that we broadcast engineers need. We'll be right back after this from our friends at Lavvo.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavvo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavvo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavvo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavvo radio tech at www.lavvo.com/twert.
Thanks so much to Lavvo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. We really appreciate that. And do go to that website, lavvo.com, and add the /twert. Take you right to the radio gear, and it'll also let them know that we sent you. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack, just finishing up this week in Radio Tech, episode 446. Stephen Kurtz has been our guest, and rather than me take up any time with a tip, or maybe I just didn't bring one, we're going to give all that time over to Stephen for a tip of the week. Steve, what's a great takeaway for broadcast engineers?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm going to put a lot of this again on our website, totalit.com/part, and get that up there for you ASAP. Some of it's already there. My big takeaway or my big tip of the week is kind of something that's a little bit more obscure in networking, but something that I use all the time, and I feel like it has a very big place inside the broadcast plant, even in office environments, things like that. And it is a term called VLAN. And a VLAN is something that you can add to your routers and to your switches to let you have different networks on one cable, on one wire. And it is a very good and effective way to segment your network out. Don't worry about having to, I got to rewire my whole thing and buy new switches, things like that. A lot of your switches already do this. And it's a very good way to protect yourself, to keep yourself segmented so the bad stuff can't get in to your most critical operations. And I'll put some more details on that, but that's my, 80-20 tease there.
And just to make sure I understand, VLANing is not just assigning different IP address segments, like a 192.168.1.something or .2.something or .3.something. VLAN tagging is even a little bit different than that, isn't it?
Absolutely. And yes, you want to put a different IP address range, but it actually physically separates your devices or your networks on one switch, on one piece of gear. So you don't have to basically, let's say you've got your studio and you've got your office networks. Well, you can run them on the same cables, on the same switches, same routers, things like that. You can put a VLAN in there. That way you have different internet access rules. You have different firewall rules, things like that. Even in between the two VLANs, so the networks can't talk to each other. It's basically like having separate networks on one cable and being able to break them out with something as simple as a switch. Or you can tell your switch, hey, I want this device to be on this VLAN, this device to be on another VLAN. VLAN stands for virtual LAN, and even things like VMware and Microsoft Windows, they are now, they can understand this tagging. And so it just makes it a lot easier to really segment your things. There's really no reason why we can't start, you know, doing even more segmentation in our facilities.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see if we can get a link to some VLAN education on our show notes
sure.
as well. And by the way, I do see that you've already started that webpage at totalit.com/twerk. That's very that's great of you. I appreciate you doing that. We'll have that the first thing in the show notes as well. Stephen, man, I appreciate you spending an hour with us. I wish we had 3 hours to spend. We could certainly talk about
Absolutely.
A lot more.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
our time is up, and I want to thank you. Tell us real quick about TotalIT.com, and if a broadcaster feels they need expert service from you guys, how do they reach you?
Absolutely. So my email address is on that totalit.com/twert, stephen.kurtz@totalit.com, or you can give us a call. Area code 972-383-7330. We don't just serve the Dallas area. We serve all over the country. We've got clients all over the place, both broadcast and non-broadcast. So we have familiarity, lots of familiarity with all things IP, all things network. Really just a great resource and really just want to make this as good as possible for people. That's our goal. And we're strictly business. We don't do, you know, residential or anything like that. We are business focused.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. We'll put that in the show notes as well. Stephen Kurtz, thank you so much for being our guest on This Week in Radio Tech.
Thank you, Kurt.
Again, our friends Chris Tobin couldn't be with us this week. Hopefully he'll be back. In fact, he may be hosting next week. I'm kind of on vacation next week, and I don't know if I'll be here or not. Depends on what my wife has planned for Thursday afternoon. So Chris may be with you doing the show himself next week. Hey, I want to thank our producer, Suncast, for doing such a great job, as always, of producing This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks a lot, Suncast. Also, thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find lots of other fine podcasts, including What the Tech and Matt Men and lots of other good stuff. So check those out right here at GFQNetwork.com. Hey, we'll be back next week with another show. I'm Kirk Harnett. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.